Hey Randy, I promise this is not another OKRs episode, although I do love those. But how many goals does your company set at a time?
Oh God, you're trying to trigger me, aren't you, Lily? I mean, the place I'm working at now is actually really good at this. We have one goal per business line with, you know, a couple of sub-goals that support it. But oh my God, do I have horror stories about this?
Yeah, I think we've probably all been there. But today's chat may help. We've got Mike Hudak, Monzo's Chief Product Officer, and he has a magic number for this and a process on how to reach it.
A magic number? Ooh, that sounds very Schoolhouse Rock. And that reference kind of really dates me. So let's get right to Mike before I embarrass myself any further.
The product experience is brought to you by Mind the Product.
Every week, we talk to the best product people from around the globe about how we can improve our practice and build products that people love.
Visit mindtheproduct.com to catch up on past episodes and to discover an extensive library of great content and videos.
Browse for free or become a Mind the Product member to unlock premium articles, unseen videos, AMAs, roundtables, discounts to our conferences around the world, training opportunities, and more.
Mind the Product also offers free Product Tank meetups in more than 200 cities, and there's probably one near you.
Mike, thank you so much for joining us today. We've been really looking forward to this talk.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
So for anyone who doesn't already know you, can you just give a quick introduction? What are you up to these days, and how did you get into this world of product-related stuff?
Yeah, so I'm Chief Product Officer at Monzo. I've been working in product, and trying to think of how old I am now. It's 20 years, more than 20 years. I dropped out of high school when I was 15 and went to work at a startup as an engineer. Did that for a couple of years until we went under. It was like 2001, something like that. And then I moved to New York and worked as an engineer at a bunch of random places, the National Hockey League, AOL, Time Warner. And then started a company with some friends doing online video in 2005. I had my commit privileges taken away from me pretty early because I was always in a meeting with somebody instead of being around to support my changes. And I think I remember causing an incident one day, and I was like in a board meeting or an investor meeting, and our CTO was like, never again, you may not. And so that was kind of, I guess, a little bit of a transition towards product. I did that for a while. We merged with another company, bought by Disney about 6 months later. And then I went out to California to work at Facebook, where I did product, and I worked on privacy and identity for a while. And then I ran the ads product team there. And I ran friend sharing, which is all the content on Facebook that comes from ordinary people, and then moved to London because my wife's English, went to work at Deliveroo as CTO, and then joined Monzo, I guess, about a however long ago the pandemic started. I can't keep track of time, but I started a CPO about a month, maybe 3 weeks before the first lockdown.
Fantastic. And one of the reasons we were really excited to talk to you, besides that illustrious resume, is you had some thoughts on a topic that comes up again and again for us, and we never have a good answer for this one. It's about how you organize your teams, because no one ever seems to get this right. There's theories about doing it by persona and customer type. There's theories about doing it by platform type. Where do you start?
Yeah, well, I think the question you have to ask is, what is a team's goal? Because I think that teams need to be able to organize around a singular thing and think about that all day, every day. And ideally, it's a customer problem or something the company wants to achieve or something that a customer wants to achieve. But obviously, there's a product surface you have to think about as well, and ownership of a product surface. I've done the platform by platform thing before, having an iOS team, having an Android team, having a web team. And I think the problem with that is that you responsibility gets diffused across, because, you know, it's just the responsibility for the app, not for actually moving any graph or moving any numbers that matter to customers. And I think that graph word is really important. I think that if you organize a set of ambitious, highly achieving, smart people around a graph, around a number that they can move and they can see move every day and you can put on the wall, I think you would be amazed by what people are capable of doing in that kind of situation, organized in that way. And anything that you can do, I think, in order to orient a team around that graph is really will be successful. Like you can say, you know, we're going to move customer engagement from, you know, 20% of daily actives to 30% of daily actives over the next 3 months. That's a great way to organize a team.
So if you had, let's say, a few different teams, and I'm assuming we're talking about kind of cross-functional product teams at this point, that have a designer and a UX person and whatever it is they need to deliver what they want to deliver, and you're setting them up so that they're working on different goals, how do you ensure that those goals aren't in conflict with each other? Because if one team is working on acquisition, say, they might then increase churn, and then you have another team that are looking at reducing churn, and they're like, hey, you guys, you just did this, and now it's like messed up all our numbers. How do you check the alignment of those different teams?
Totally. So one thing that I think is very powerful, if you can, is to have metrics that capture the negative externalities that you might create as much as possible. So perhaps instead of goaling against new customers or churn, you goal against active customers, because then the team can hold responsibility for both things and can decide autonomously how to trade off between those things, right? Because as you say, otherwise you end up gaming the metric and you're like, okay, I can get a million users, but you know, 950,000 of them won't be active tomorrow. I hit my goal. So I think as much as you can, find that compound metric that captures both the change you're trying to make in the world and the ways that you could game it. Failing that, you can have health metrics. So you can say, you know, onboard at least a million new customers while maintaining a churn level of no more than 15%, something of that nature. And those kind of goals, I think, also work really well. They kind of emphasize to a team what matters. And at the end of a planning cycle, you can look at that and determine whether or not you hit your goal and whether or not you did so in a healthy way.
I want to go two totally different places with this. So I'm going to start with the low level and we'll come back to the high level. So I'm curious about how you structure the teams themselves. So, you know, people aren't resources, but you need to resource the teams with certain capabilities. And I've seen some companies do it by going, we want all full stack devs so we can be platform and technology agnostic and not to be dependent on anyone else. I've seen other people say, actually, no, we need specialists in this area. How do you approach it?
Well, in terms of engineering, I think it's probably very stage dependent and the nature of the work. So when you're very small, when you're one or two engineers, I think it's hard to get away with anything other than full stack developers. As you grow, you can get all the way to the limit and say, I have release engineering, I have security engineering, you know, and you get deeply specialized. At a mid-stage company or a scale up or something which is like Series A, Series B, I think now you're starting to look at real differentiation at the level of like, I'm an iOS engineer, I'm an Android engineer, I'm a web engineer, I'm a backend engineer. And then that's also when I think you start breaking off like a platform team and stuff like that. It's probably not until you're thousands of people that you have a specialist release engineering team, although, you know, some products might demand that. And then I think there's also the question of like, what kind of product manager you would have and what kind of designer you would have. You know, do you have somebody who's more IA focused, more focused on information architecture, or somebody who's more interaction focused, you know, which is I still believe you should hire generalists, but, you know, people kind of move in one direction or the other. And then with product managers, you'll have specialists who specialize in like, you know, lending, for example, and know that inside and out. And then you have generalists. And again, finding a good balance between those people in your area, I think is also very important.
And in the companies that you've worked in, have you seen, gone through those different shifts of ways of working? And presumably there are challenges that come alongside then changing from, say, a full stack team to a more specialized setup.
Yeah, hugely. I think, you know, and I've seen that at different stages and different sizes. I mean, one thing that I've definitely seen is like transitioning to having like a core data engineering team, for example, and teams having to figure out how to move things in to be supported by that team, and what the contract is between like a product team and a data engineering team is actually a very, very hard thing to figure out. you know, what the product team is used to being in control of its own destiny and running its own infrastructure, but also like it's more efficient for somebody else to provide that as a service. How does that work? How do things get prioritized? That's a legitimately really hard problem. And you see this as well. You know, I think when I started at Facebook, there were like 7 people who worked on photos. Maybe it was 20, you know, and then that team becomes like 100 people and 150 people. And you go from, we used to have this thing where like, if you're hiring a PM from Google, your job was, you know, optimizing a 300 by 250 pixel box somewhere on the AdWords screen. And your job here will be running photos. You know, it's just like a completely different scale. But then you have to bring a company through the transition in the other direction, where eventually your job again is going to be a 300 by 250 pixel box. And that's a very difficult transition, I think, for an organization to go through and people to go through.
How did you see that happening successfully? Like, what were the sort of main things that happened to make that go well?
Well, it didn't always. I mean, some people will say, you know, my scope is shrinking and I just don't want to do this anymore. Yeah. And that will happen. I think that the conversation to happen there, to have there, is around impact. And how many people's lives are you touching? What kind of changes? What kind of scale are you operating at? You know, it's possible that just running the comment box on photos now has more impact than running all the photos a year or two ago, right? In fact, I think that's likely true in lots of different places and lots of different examples. And so you can have that conversation and talk about like going deeper into a thing and doing it really, really well as well. But, you know, Molly Graham, who was early at Facebook, wrote a great post about this called Giving Up Your Legos. And she's absolutely brilliant. And it's just such a good post. And I think captures everything here better than I possibly could. But it is really all about impact. It's having a conversation about impact. And I think that great cultures are built around impact and people seeking impact and being incentivized around impact and being excited by it. And that base cultural layer, which also influences how you set goals, how you work against goals, how you think about your team's role, that is also the thing that can affect how you feel about an organization scaling up and there being more people around you.
So how do you avoid, as you scale these teams up, you go from being in charge of photos to being in charge of a 250 square box. That means there's a lot of other teams as well. How do you avoid cross-team dependencies as you scale? Because that's a problem I've seen happen again and again and again. You go from executing to just waiting for other people to do the thing you asked.
Yeah. I think one thing that is really important, which is a maxim I've tried to live by, is decouple everything. Like, do not, to the extent possible, have no dependencies. And to the extent that you do have dependencies, have them be kind of like well documented with an SLA around them. And what I mean by that is you might be dependent on, like, you know, at the extreme, at the limit of a really big company, you might be dependent on a platform team to provide your database. But that should be a well-contracted relationship, and everything else you should be able to do completely independently. You know, I think it's relatively rare that you find dependencies which are truly unmanageable in a separate way. You know, I can think of like a new redesign coming out and you having to wait in order to ship your thing into the new redesign might be an example. But in that case, the way that you handle that, I think, is that the entire company has to mobilize around getting that redesign done as quickly as possible so that everybody can ship into the new surface and not waste time. And I think if people's goals are good and well set, it'll be in everybody's interest, you know, independent, and the culture is good, it'll be in everybody's interest to go and help do that so that the dependency is cleared and you can go ship on top of it.
You make it sound way too easy.
Well, I'm trying to think of an example.
There's a big caveat there with if the culture is good, and that, yes. I think that's the scary part in a lot of places.
Definitely, and I think almost everything leads back to culture, right?
And I think one of the other things, so we've talked about that kind of that cross-functional product team, which is often, you know, your QA, your engineer, your designer, UX, and your product manager. But then you also have your sales and marketing and legal and all, you know, compliance or any of those other teams that you're impacting. So how do you see that kind of changing, or as teams grow and you get kind of more of these cross-functional product teams, like how do you see them then interfacing with these other groups so that they're all still able to achieve the goals? Or there must be like, as a legal team going, oh, I've got all of these different product teams asking me for these different things, and I don't, you know, how do they end up prioritizing their workload?
So I think you have to start prioritization goals at the company level, which is really important. So I think the CEO has to stand up in front of the company and say, these are the three things that matter to this company for the next 3 months, 6 months, a year, whatever the right time frame is. Probably 6 months. You always end up at 6 months. Talk about 12, talk about three, it's 6 months. And these are the three things that are kind of like non-negotiable, do or die. And one of them is super ambitious. And one of them, like, we should just get done in our sleep. And then there's one in between. I don't know. But there are three things that matter. And they are at the top of a stack ranked list where there is no number four. This is the way that I do it. Not everybody does. And if you are on a legal team or a finance team or an engineering team, it is expected that you will do everything that you possibly can in order to achieve these three goals. And that anything that is not on the list, with a very important caveat, is less important and gets out of the way. And the caveat is that you need to do a set of things to stay alive. And those things can't be deprioritized. So you can't deprioritize platform health. You can't deprioritize compliance. You know, those things need to be done, and they need to be done well. But then when you look at all of the product initiatives you can have in the company, all of the, you know, project work that a legal team could do, you ask yourself, is it serving these three objectives? And if not, why am I doing it? And then typically the way that I would do that then is to cascade that throughout the organization. So you might have areas, which are collections of multiple teams. Each one of those would have three things to do. And then each individual team, or some folks will call them squads, will have three things to do. And in my world, no more than three, and ideally only one. And then you can just focus around that and you can get that done. And it's incredibly clarifying. Just don't do any of the other stuff.
Sprig, formerly UserLeap, is an all-in-one product research platform that lets you ask bite-sized questions to your customers within your product or existing user journeys.
Companies like Dropbox, Square, Opendoor, Loom, and Shift all use Sprig's video interviews, concept tests, and micro surveys to understand their customers at the pace of modern software development so they can build customer-centric products that deliver a sustainable competitive advantage.
So if you're part of an agile product team that wants to obtain rich insights from users at the pace you ship products, then give Sprig a try for free by visiting sprig.com. Again, that's Sprig, SPRIG.com.
So how long does it take you to put that together on a quarterly basis? Because, you know, there's that whole thing of it's very easy when you're at the top table to say it's these three things, but not to fully understand all the implications of what you're asking for. And the further down the stack you go, the more they say, oh God, that means this and this, and I have to rebuild this, I have to do that, or they have to skimp on something else. How long does it take, and how do you go through that process to make sure you're doing it well?
So it depends on the company, the size of company, and the complexity, right? And I think you can come up with a list of things that matter to the company, those three things. Honestly, I think most companies can do it in a day. They just choose not to. But I think that if you get a group of five people together who help lead that company with a whiteboard, I would be shocked if they can't figure out what those three things are. And you might not get to total, you might not get to total agreement. You might not get to full consensus, but you'll know what they are. So you could do that quite quickly. And if they're done right, one of them might be like launch a product, like a ship goal. But I usually encourage people to make them metrics based and say, well, I don't really care about whether or not you ship the product. I just want 100,000 people using it, which I guess implies that you've shipped it. But, you know, it's 100,000 that matter, not having shipped it.
Ship with two customers is not the goal.
Yeah, exactly right. Yeah. You have accomplished nothing. Until you scale it, you know, that you may have gotten 99% of the work done. We don't know. But yeah, get to 100,000 customers on the new product. And then you ask every team to do it. And I think the trick is that you want to do, and Randy, this gets to your question, you want to do bottom up, top down. So you kind of want the company to issue guidance. Like, these are the three things that really matter. And then you want every team coming up and saying, well, this is what I can actually achieve. This is what I can do. This is how I can contribute to that. And then you have a meeting in the middle where everybody gets together and says, oh, well, why can't you hit this objective that we set? Do we need to get you more? Do we need to change things? Do we need to change the goal? And that'll take a few, again, depending on how big the company is, a couple days or something like that. So at the limit, for a small to mid-sized company, I think you can do this in a few days. I think for a big company of hundreds or thousands of people, realistically, it's a few weeks.
So you're doing that conversation, I'm guessing, with your product leads and your engineering leads in the room at the same time so that they understand the trade-offs to each other. You're not doing these in one-to-ones.
No, this will be, you know, at the end when you're actually doing the reviews, I think. Company leadership, CFO, CEO, CTO, and then from each team, engineering, product design, legal if it's appropriate, everybody who's part of that team that needs to deliver that outcome. But, you know, as few people as possible, you need to balance it, because otherwise you're not going to have a frank conversation in the room.
And do you see those support functions? Have you, over the years, have you seen them changing the way that they work in order to support the changing way in which product teams work? Because there's generally like such a focus around the goals, and the product teams are delivering those goals. So do you see that these other kind of supporting functions are changing the way that they're working in order to facilitate the product team's work?
Hugely. So one thing I think that I've seen, which is really great, is integrating legal, compliance, all of these different roles within a product team. And depending on how many people you have and how big the team is, that could be at the company level. It could be at the area level. It could be at the individual team level. Whatever's appropriate and matches your circumstance, but actually making them feel as part of the team. And not always thinking about them as support functions, but rather thinking about, you know, legal as being a part of the product that you ship. You know, the TOS are, the terms of service are important. They're part of what we're building. And they're not just there to like write the terms of service afterwards. Maybe we, if it's important, maybe we actually think about that at the beginning at the same time we're thinking about wireframes, you know, and the lawyer is in there helping with that initial product process just as much as a designer is. And I think that also makes everybody feel really invested in the outcomes you're trying to drive. And they start, you know, the lawyer starts thinking about this as their product as much as anybody else. And I think that's incredibly powerful. And then organizationally, I think a great organization will, everybody in the company is pulling in the same direction. So hopefully you have a leadership team which is sitting there aligned around those goals, where the chief legal officer, the general counsel, feels as much ownership over hitting that goal as the CTO or CPO.
So I want to flip the perspective on this a little bit. We've been talking about the view from the top table. Let's talk about if you are the product manager or part of the product team on something, and this goal comes down and you say, oh, crap. There's just no way we can hit this in this time frame. You know, the most dangerous word in our profession is just. And someone says, can't we just do this? And you say, no, we can't. And here's 15 reasons why. But you don't want to walk into that meeting and sabotage your career by saying no to everybody more senior than you. What mistakes have you seen people make in that meeting, or, you know, not responding too well? And how can you handle it well? How do you communicate back and say, this isn't realistic. Here is what is.
So first of all, I think you want to work in a company that values truth. And we've talked a lot about culture, but like, you as an individual get to choose to the maximum extent possible where you work. And you should work at a place that values truth. And so if you don't feel comfortable saying, I can't get this done, you should consider where you're working. Now, there are two possible reasons, though, why you might not feel comfortable saying that. One is, because you're being asked to do the impossible. And the other is because you're not being ambitious or creative enough. And it's really important to try to differentiate between those two. And it's an uncomfortable process to try to figure that out. Having done that, if you're going to say, I can't achieve this no matter what, to go back and explain why. And, you know, you have to think about whether or not, if you were in the other seat, you would come back and say you're not being ambitious enough and why, and think through that and really, you know, be intellectually honest with yourself. If the answer is you think that there's a possibility that you could get it done, then you sit down and with a whiteboard and your team and you try to figure it out. And if you still can't find a way, you go back and you say, I can't do it. But the best, you know, I've seen people do this in both directions so many times. My favorite example of this, which is completely different, Randy, than the question you're asking, but I'll mention it anyway, is a team came to us at one point at Facebook saying, we're going to get to 1 million advertisers in the next 6 months. And I think at the time we had about 150,000. And the leadership team said, you're nuts. You're never going to do this. It's impossible. And they said, you know what? It's possible that we won't do it. We agree. But we want to try. We want to set our goal as 1 million. And everybody hemmed and hawed and said, well, you know, we don't want teams here to have unrealistic goals. And, you know, that could be really bad and so on and so forth. They were like, no, we want to do it. And they did it. I think they hit like 1.4 million in that 6 months. And it was absolutely incredible. I mean, it was one of the best things I've ever seen. And then on the flip side, I've definitely been guilty of asking teams to sign up for unrealistic goals, having them come back and say, I can't achieve this, and saying, you're not being creative enough. You're not thinking through this enough. Sign up to it. You'll figure out how to do it. And being wrong and having the team absolutely crushed under the weight of that. And that's way more destructive than asking them to hit a realistic goal and then beating it and coming up. And so if you're a PM stuck in the middle of this, the key is to know what situation you're in and to work at a company that values truth and really to ask yourself, what is the best that I can do in my seat right now? And sometimes the answer is actually, this is the wrong goal entirely. You're asking me to target monthly active users, and I believe the highest leverage thing is to get daily active users. And then your job is to go back to management and say, you know, you're setting the wrong goal and here's why. And you may or may not be right, and you need to be open to that. And company leadership may or may not be right, and they have to be open to that.
So, I mean, that sounds challenging on multiple sort of levels of like being able to understand where you are. I guess you just get there with experience, or like, is there something else that you can do in order to know this stuff better?
To know the difference between whether or not something is realistic or you need more ambition?
Yeah, exactly. Because we're all unique individuals as well. And I think that's the other thing is, you know, you will get people who are just much more ambitious and just go, okay, I don't care if it's realistic or not. I just like, give me a challenge, and they'll relish that. And then other people who will just, you know, they want it to be something that they can achieve because they will get satisfaction from achieving it. But if they're not looking like they're going to achieve it, they will crumble. And, you know, exactly like you're saying, I guess maybe it's like a leadership thing as well of knowing what's the right strategy for the product person too.
Yeah, absolutely. And I've definitely been guilty of getting that wrong and misunderstanding a team and thinking that they were the type that needed a really big, ambitious goal to organize around, but actually they're the type who needs to make, you know, slow and steady progress. And that is a thing. And I think, you know, knowing that about yourself is incredibly important. And to some degree, working in the right place based on that, you know, there are different parts of an organization typically and different specialties within product which lend themselves to one or the other. You know, I work with incredible people who like to dependently deliver incremental change that adds up to something really, really big over time. And then I work with people who like to take huge, risky swings that may be zero or maybe 1,000. And in any company, there are going to be places where each of those things are more appropriate than others. And so finding that fit between the work and your personality, I think is really important. And then you'll find yourself in that conflict less on a day-to-day basis.
Do you think as well, it's almost, you know, how some companies will set values, a lot of companies these days set values, that there may be more of a bias these days towards the ambitious, like, go get it type of way of working, rather than the, no, I want to set something achievable and more pragmatic?
I think it really depends on the company. And I think even this, you know, you can think about different ways of working where you make lots of small changes that add up to really big outcomes. And you just work on kind of like incremental improvement after incremental improvement. And you can do that without being bombastic and going after the big headline number, and yet still deliver something really big. And I think on the other hand, you could do something huge and have it be ill-conceived. And of course, it's like high beta, it can be binary and not get there. I think each company needs a mix of both. And I think that it would be wrong to say that any company over the fullness of its life should organize around one or the other of those extremes. There will be times when each is appropriate, and you need to know which those are, and you need to know what type of product leader you are, and therefore what parts of the organization or what organizations to work at.
So, and in order to kind of know that, one of the things that I've done a couple of times in a few different companies that I've worked in is these like psychometric tests. Like, there's a whole huge variety of them out there. Do you tend to do that in the places where you work, or do you find value in things like that? Or
yeah, Monzo does Discovery Insights, and I have been shocked by how accurate they feel. And I think that as people have done them, I've read people's and had this, you know, aha moment of like, oh, everything makes sense now. You know, I know a different way to work with you. It's been really phenomenal. And I find that mine describes me well. I find that for 99% of the people I work with, it's uncanny, actually. Mm. And I find
it is fascinating. Yeah.
You like them.
I did one. I used to be so skeptical of them, but I did one very recently. I can't remember. See Me Color Profile, I think it's called. That described me incredibly well. And it's just very interesting that we now can shortcut getting to know each other by doing like a little quiz and then reading a document. But yeah.
It's incredible. Yeah.
Okay, so taking one step back from this, and Mike, we're running out of time. This has been really fantastic. So I think this is probably the last question. We talked a lot about company culture. We talked a lot about how to set that culture. But if you're someone who's thinking about joining a company and finding one that values honesty and the right kind of culture, how do you recommend people to do that during their job search? How do you determine, when a company's putting its best foot forward, whether they are living up to their values, whether they're the right kind of place to work?
I think it's helpful if people tell you real things in an interview. Everybody should give you an opportunity to ask questions. And if they don't, you shouldn't work there. And when you ask questions, you should ask hard questions. And if people tell you that everything is perfect, you shouldn't work there. If people give you a measured answer with the good and the bad and help you make a good decision about where to work, that's a really good sign. I'd also try to spend some time with people who work there outside of an interview setting, have coffee with them, have a beer with them, have lunch, and get an opportunity again to learn about the company. And it's so important. Every single company has things that are wrong with it. And if people aren't willing to tell you that, then they're not honest. And similarly though, on the other hand, if they're so negative, well, you don't want to work there either. There's a nice in between, and you'll kind of know it when you find it. But it's incredibly important.
Yeah. Saying, okay, I understand that these are things you say that are negative about the company. They're not so bad for me. I can live with that. That's not such a bad thing.
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
Mike, that's a really good answer and a great way to wrap this up. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, both of you. Thank you, Randy. Thank you, Lily. Really appreciate the chance.
I love it. De La Soul and Schoolhouse Rock were both right. 3 is the magic number.
It's okay, Randy. Sometimes you oldies are actually right about things. You just need to be reminded about it every now and then.
Oh, God. Well, you know, my memory is going, but I'm just going to tell you to get off my lawn, Lily. See you next week.
Our hosts are me, Lily Smith, and
me, Randy Silver.
Emily Tate is our producer, and Luke Smith is our editor.
Our theme music is from Hamburg-based band POW, that's P-A-U. Thanks to Arne Kittler, who runs Product Tank and MTP Engage in Hamburg, and plays bass in the band, for letting us use their music. Connect with your local product community via Product Tank, our regular free meetups in over 200 cities worldwide.
If there's not one near you, you can consider starting one yourself. To find out more, go to mindtheproduct.com/producttank.
Product Tank is a global community of meetups driven by and for product people. We offer expert talks, group discussion, and a safe environment for product people to come together and share learnings and tips.